So the title for the talk this afternoon is The Space Between the Words. The Space Between the Words. And just looking around the hall and kind of come back to what I said before, the space between the people here. And maybe sometimes we can feel the others who were here over the days, still in those spaces, in a way. Not physically, but maybe in more important ways, still here. So, when we were traveling to Sarnath, when we started our 48-hour journey in South India, we were on the platform waiting for the train. And there were other Westerners on the platform waiting on the train for the train. So, like you do, you know, start talking and where are you going, and found out that one of them was also heading to Varanasi, like we were, changing trains in Mumbai. And we started talking about different trains, and he was on one train, and we were on the other train, and we were on the faster train. And how did that happen, that we were on the faster train and he was on the slow train? And how hard it is to book tickets these days on Indian trains. And so I said to him, you know, well, we booked this ticket in kind of sometime in November. I think sometime at the end of November, we booked this ticket. And he was really shocked. He was really, really shocked that we'd booked so many months in advance. And he said something like, but how can you be free like that? Like, how can you be free when you know 3 months in advance what you're going to do, when you're going to get on this train and where you're going to go? And I don't wish in any way to judge him. I mean, I think my interpretation of he was using free as spontaneous. But Nathan and I were just kind of like taken aback by the question. You know, how can you be free? And we were smiling at each other and at him. And we didn't have a reply. But it's really come back, this story has come back to me the last few days with this question of, how can I be free? And what is freedom? What is freedom? And obviously we all know that beautiful sense that he was speaking about of just being able to feel what is the next right thing to do in doing that. And there is a real sense of freedom in that. And traveling in India is a great opportunity for us to connect to that beauty. But somehow I didn't feel that we were less free despite having made that decision such a long time before. But maybe we were experiencing a different taste, a different type of freedom. And this word freedom comes up a lot over the days here and in this kind of teaching. And that question, what is freedom? What is a free life? Comes up a lot. Sometimes in those words and sometimes in other words. And many times we may have this idea that freedom is about freedom of choice. One idea. Spontaneity. Like our friend on the platform. Or a freedom from something. Whatever that something is, that can change, to be free of. To be free of certain aspects of myself or of life that make me unhappy. To not have them anymore. And last night, when a group of us was meeting with Christopher, this kind of issue came up, and he was quoting the Buddha, speaking about a different taste of freedom, I would say. A freedom that is present within life. A freedom that is present within life. Not away from. And the way the Buddha was speaking about it was this ability to be still. Even within what I would call the push-me-pull-yous of life. I just remembered one of my youngest nephew's favorite book, Dr. Dolittle. And there's an amazing, amazing creature in it called the push-me-pull-you. I haven't managed to translate that name into Hebrew, but somehow we get the drift. The push-me-pull-you, it's a creature who has two heads. For those of you who don't know this book, a creature that has two heads, one on either side. Instead of a tail, it's got another head. And they're always arguing with each other. Always pushing, one pulling this way and one pulling that way. So a great metaphor for our experience. So that stillness with whatever is coming from outside into us, affecting us, affecting our lives, affecting our experience, as well as with whatever is coming from inside, our emotions, our mind states, our reactions, whatever it is, a stillness with that movement. And we were speaking about how subtle that is, that stillness. And how it's not the movements that stop. It's not the movements that stop. But somehow it's that sense of stillness that grows. And an image that was coming from what other people were saying and also my own experience was how when we meditate, when we sit here on the cushion, we take as our center, as our focus, sometimes I feel as my home on the cushion, what we call an object of meditation. For most of us, it's the breath. We center ourselves in the breath. That's the thing that we can stay steady with. And I feel that in a similar way, that can happen in our lives, in everything we do. Our meditation practice, our love of Dharma, our sincere, our real, authentic wish for freedom, as that center point that keeps us steady, that we come back to. Kind of the same kind of image, the same movement. And around that center, our life can grow. We can say, so I want to talk more about what it is we practice, if that's where we're going, if that's the kind of freedom we're talking of, that freedom of stillness within the movement of life, of presence within the movement of life. And it feels like there's two questions there. One is, what is it that we practice? And also, how do we practice that? And popping up with a how feels right now, what's coming with a how, one thing that comes is taking it slow. Taking it slow in the listening, taking it slow in the speaking right now. When I was kind of feeling into what to say today, what to talk about, Nathan said to me, he's my mentor, by the way, in case you don't know. He said to me, just talk about your practice. Just talk about your practice. Just talk about what you do. I was like, wow, that's a good idea. So I'm going to try. It's not so easy to articulate. And so when I was kind of turning in to really look and try this, to try and articulate, to try and find the words, one thing that came was really this wish, this intention, this willingness to take life as my practice. And again, that image of whatever is coming at me from life and whatever is coming through me from life. That is my practice. And not just as words, like it's really important for me to say that, not just words, not just an idea. And I've said it in some groups, I have this image of it as turning my eyes in. Turning my eyes in to really look at what is going on inside. And another way of saying it is that whatever is happening is a reminder, is a wake-up call. In the group today, people were telling us about different ways of reminding themselves in daily life to be mindful, to connect. Tom was telling us about this computer program he has on his computer, which at random intervals makes the sound of a bell ringing. And so for someone who spends a lot of time on his computer working, you know, then the bell of mindfulness coming from his computer. It's beautiful. It's really beautiful. It's such a simple thing. And it's what he's doing all the time. So then in that, the reminder. And so the reminder is not just to be mindful, not just to be aware. But it feels like it can go deeper than that. A little bit for me. It's kind of a reminder that whatever is happening is okay, and that whatever is happening is useful. And so it's really important to understand, this can be quite a confusing point, I feel. It doesn't mean that if bad things are happening to me, I'm justifying them. Or if bad things are happening to somebody else, I'm saying, that's fine, you know, bad things can happen because we learn from them. It's not that. It's not that. But it's more like if something bad is happening, then I have the opportunity to also learn from it, to also grow from it, and to also connect to life through it. And as Sandhya was saying yesterday, most of us have this tendency to connect through the painful things, but it's equally possible through the joy. It's not just one type of experience which is useful. And for many of us, it's in the joy when we lose ourselves, maybe. So that's the place to connect, in the energy of the joy. So growing the capacity to be still within life, within experience. And another way of saying it is to become intimate with life as it shows itself. And so if I'm noticing that I'm confused or worrying or fearful, or high on something, or full of love, connecting to how that really feels in myself, and equally knowing that that is something that I share with all human beings, that these qualities that I get to know in myself are equally present in all of life. And so one example that was coming from one of the people here was about this fear when making choices about their life. From a really authentic place of wanting to make sure that I'm making the right choices, that I am moving with what matters to me, that I'm staying true to what I value. And then fear coming. What if I make the wrong choice? What if I do the wrong thing? So another Nathan story is coming. I promised him I wasn't going to tell a lot of stories, but they just keep popping up. So this is quite a personal one. I hope you don't mind. So when we met, I was in a relationship with somebody else, and we fell in love, and there was still this other person in my life, somewhere else in India, and I was telling this to a couple of people yesterday. This was 11 years ago. There was no email in India then. The contact was by faxes. So I was sending faxes to my boyfriend, and he was sending back, and we were trying to tell each other what was happening. And Nathan and I were falling in love, and I would go from this sense of, like, really being in love to, well, what about this other guy that I was so in love with and feeling I was committed to? Like, what's going on, you know? And I would go from this sense of love and openness and joy to feeling very, very confused and very responsible. And Nathan, used to say to me every once in a while, just stop trying to do the right thing. Just stop trying to do the right thing. Just live. Because in that situation, the doing the right thing was panic. It was trying to figure it out. And as most of us know, love can't be figured out. It's not something to figure out. So somehow just remembering to stop doing the right thing. So there's confusion, there's unknown, there's a tough situation, there's seemingly a choice to be made, this guy or this guy. Seemingly. And of course, when we look into it, it gets more complicated. My view of myself as a good person who doesn't do this kind of thing, that also has to be let go of. That's hard. The trust in myself. I thought I was in love with someone. How can I suddenly be in love with someone else? And yet, that was the truth. That was the truth. I don't have another boyfriend now, by the way. If anyone's wondering. But that being able to, when that panic comes and when that tension comes, to let go, to stop trying to do the right thing and just let go into life and feel what is right. And in that situation, it was possible to move through that situation with very little pain for anyone, amazingly enough. And we're both really good friends with the man who was my boyfriend at the time and his wife. So that is possible. That is possible. It doesn't mean that it always happens, but I feel like being in this situation at the time, coming after a long retreat and being on retreat here and having that reminder of just stop doing the right thing was really helpful. And so in those situations of choice, of confusion, if we can just let go into the process itself without needing to figure out the end necessarily. Just taking it slow, like I was saying before. Taking it slow. And this can include making mistakes. I mean, in that same situation, it could have been possible that I would have ended up heartbroken. It could. But if we also have the willingness to learn from the mistakes as well as to make them, then there's a chance. Growth can happen. And so I want to go back to that sentence, stop doing the right thing, because I feel that's something that can be really useful as a practice. And over the days, many people have mentioned things like that that they use, sometimes knowingly and sometimes unknowingly. Something that we've heard, something that somebody said to us, something that we've read, or something that's come up spontaneously from ourselves. And we often really do it unconsciously, and it can be so useful. So yeah, that sentence was following me for quite a few years. Stop trying to do the right thing. Someone else was saying in one of the groups how a sentence that another participant said last year in a group has become their mantra, has followed them, and really been helpful. For some reason, I can't, even though it was also, that same sentence was also resonating with me through the year, right now I can't really fully remember it. But it's something about doing, just doing the next right thing. And again, not trying to figure out the whole story. Not trying to plan our route to the end while we're still sitting here. But willing to take the steps, one right step at a time. And I call these sentences inner mantras because I think they're very, very helpful and very, very personal. And so I have a few to share. Maybe they'll be useful. So one that I really love is from my friend Ajay. And he often speaks of the whittling of the self. It's a weird word, whittle. And it's, again, I'm pretty visual, so maybe that's why I like it. Whittling is like having a piece of wood and with very manually shaving off very, very thin layers of it, whittling. And so that's a really, really helpful, has been really helpful for me in practice, just remembering that's what we're doing. Very, very, very slowly, very, very patiently, whittling. Thin, thin layers, thin layer, thin layer, thin layer of the self. Another one that was useful for me, has been useful for me many times, is the sense when I see something in myself that is really hard to see. Jealousy, competition, narrow-mindedness, judgment. Someone asked me today if I'm ever grumpy. And I just want to say, you know, I'll give you my mother's email address. A lot. I'm grumpy a lot. I get stressed. You know, I do all that stuff. We all do. So when those come and when I see it and I feel that, just remembering, this is also just another piece of wood in this fire of practice, in this fire of liberation. Seeing it, feeling the heat, feeling the pain. There's a quote from Ananda Mahima, an Indian saint, and when her disciples used to come to her and say, you know, I'm seeing all this crap. Like, what do I do with this in me? And she used to say to them, but this also is God. This also is God. This is also a manifestation, an expression of life, of divine. And what happens when we look at our shadows, when we look at our ugliness in that way? My sense is that it allows us to live from a much wider place than just this. When we include all of ourself, then we include a lot more of life. Jesus said, judge not, lest you be judged. And one interpretation I've heard of that quote is about our own, when we judge others, we actually strengthen our own judgment, self-judgment as well. And it works the same way the other direction. Whatever violence we use against ourselves, the less open we are to life and to others. And so really what freedom is to me in many ways is accepting the diversity of life. The diversity of God, we can say also, if we like to use that word. That nothing in life is limited to just one narrow manifestation. And that includes ourselves. And that includes our partner, even when they do the thing that annoys us the most that they do. They're not just that. And any person, any event, any action, if we can see how it's made out of all the conditions, all the ingredients, it's not just that one layer. It's like one of those cakes that kids like, with the different layers and the terrible icing in the middle. Multi-layered. Full of stuff, you can say, full of stuff. Some of it delicious and some of it horrible. And I feel that this is so important in our relationships with others, as well as in our relationship with ourselves. I feel like I've had this one ongoing story with someone quite close for quite a few years now. And because we have many mutual friends, I would regularly hear what that person was saying about me. And recently I realized that it was always really hard to make a whole out of that. Make something whole. So on one hand, you know, I'd hear that they thought I was a terrible person. And then on the other hand, I'd know that they were also doing things that were very supportive for me. And so my conclusion was, this person is just this huge hypocrite. You know, obviously what they think of me is the horrible stuff, and they have some reason for doing the nice stuff, which isn't true. But when we look at ourselves, we see that we also don't act consistently. Nothing is consistent in that way. Nothing stays the same. And so someone can love us and hate us in a way at the same time, as we do with others, with people that are close to us. Love them and can't stand them sometimes. And it can be really hard to accept, but again, if we can just remember to look for it again and again, to notice when we are doing this limited view and seeing if we can expand. Or if we can just remember that it's not just that I'm seeing now. There's more to it. Some of it I know and some of it I don't, and some of it I'll never know, but it's there. And in many ways, that's the point where transformation can happen. When we can allow the different layers, when we can allow the diversity. When we don't necessarily know everything all the time. And the reason, well, it's not the reason perhaps, but the title for this talk, The Space Between the Words, came from the Kabir group that Peter did a few days ago. Some people here were there. And it came up right at the end. This sense that we sometimes get from beautiful poetry, that the meaning is as much in the space between the words as in the words themselves. And sometimes it feels like that's really where we should be listening, in the space between the words, in the space behind the words. And that's also something I've really learned for myself with teachings. So when I used to listen to Dharma teachings or other spiritual teachings, I used to hear things like, there's all these things that you're doing wrong, Zohar. There's all these things that you are doing wrong. And here's a list of everything that you're doing wrong. And the Buddha knew that you were going to do this wrong. 2,500 years ago, he was already speaking about me. And one day, I was listening to teaching and suddenly it clicked. They're not trying to tell me what I'm doing wrong. They're not trying to tell me that I am doing it wrong. I could suddenly hear the love that was in the spaces between the words. The care, the commitment, the wanting to support me and everyone else on this journey. And that love was expressed by describing this path, describing the challenges, describing the difficulties, as well as describing the joy. So that we would have at least some help, some understanding. So that when something comes up in me, I know that someone else has already experienced something similar. And may even have some helpful advice. We were actually also talking about it in relationship to one of Nathan's music books, where the music teacher is talking about creativity, about not copying, but allowing some of your own flavor to come through. And also how that can make us feel stressed. Now I need to be creative. Oh no. And it reminded me of working with some children that I work with every year. And this is, again, in the leprosy community in central India that I've mentioned sometime, that we spend time in. And there's a school there for deaf children that we work in, that we play in. Work is not probably the right word. And so every year we come to the school, and our way of connecting, or you could say our way of getting past the teachers and to the kids, is to do some arts activities, creative activities with the children. And so we kind of try to bring with us some interesting materials, things that they're not very likely to have met before. And what's been really interesting to see is we come with the material, and the way children are taught in general, I think, but in India it's particularly strong, is a copying. So the children kind of sit there. They're really, really good kids in school. They sit there and they wait for us to show them what to do. And so we'll take a piece of modeling clay or a pipe cleaner or something, and we'll make a shape, and then they'll all take it and they'll copy. They'll make the same shape. And what we found is that usually if we just give it some time, suddenly they'll start doing their own thing. And many, many times, it'll be a few different children in the class, more or less at the same time, not seeing each other, not looking at each other, but spontaneously at the same time, they'll start doing their own thing. They'll start creating. They'll start being part of that. And it's really amazing. It's also, I've noticed that the younger the children are, the quicker it happens. This burst of spontaneous creativity. And I feel like we can learn also, again, from that to go slow with ourselves. to let that come through, to let that creativity happen, not to feel that there's something wrong with me because I'm not finding my way, but to be patient. And I kind of come towards the end with just this one big thing I want to say. And I hope I'll be able to say it. And it's another sentence from Ajay. And often when he's translating texts which speak about the motivation, the intention for doing this, to asking these questions about freedom, for going on this path into the unknown, he uses the phrase that the best motivation, the purest motivation, is one of being manure. In other words, of being shit, or the shit of animals, which has the possibility to fertilize. So being willing, or even not just willing, really deeply wanting to be manure, to be fertilizer for our own growth and for transformation in life. So not to be the gardener, not to be the sun, not to be the rain, to be the smelly stuff. To be the smelly stuff that has the nutrients for love, for compassion, for wisdom, for clarity, for whatever it is that touches us as what we aspire to. And I feel that there's such a life-affirming feeling to that. To be for. And Sandhya and I were speaking about her talk and my talk. We both had this kind of thing of for and against. That we kind of have, one of the choices we have is in our attitude. And that we have the choice to be for life, to be for ourselves, to be for each other. To really nurture that wish to fertilize, to help grow. And I feel like that deep intention is not just an idea, it's not just from the mind. But it comes from a place that knows what is possible within each of us. A place that knows what is possible. In each of us. And so I'm going to just tell one more short little story about the children in Anandawan on that tone of what is possible. And so I mentioned working with the deaf children, and in Anandawan there's also a school for blind children. And the blind and the deaf children, they're both boarding schools, they live together. All the girls in one building, all the boys in one building. And so you have blind children living with deaf children. And you can imagine that the communication is pretty difficult. And the blind children think the deaf children are idiots. And the deaf children think the blind children are hopeless. And most of the time, they're pretty mean to each other, I have to say. But then there's these moments, like when the dinner bell goes and the deaf children can't hear. And so the blind children that have some sight will go to the nearest deaf child and go like this, which is the sign for the bell is ringing, to let them know it's time for food. Or when the deaf children notice one of the blind children going off track, about to hit a wall or fall down, they'll go and stop them with such gentleness and care. And one of the challenges we have when we on days when there's no school and we want to do something with all of them, it's like, how do we bring all of them together? How do we do something with the blind and the deaf, with the boys and the girls, all together? Impossible. Always felt impossible. Because they get pretty manic also when they're outside school, I have to say. And if we try and bring something out, it just becomes a million kids with the blind children shouting and the deaf children poking. It gets pretty unpleasant. And so this year, there were quite a lot of us working with the children. And towards the end, we actually had a lot of supplies left. We had a lot of stuff left. And we just thought, okay, we'll just take it. We'll hide it in our bags, because if it's too obvious, they find it. And we'll go and we'll just start and we'll see what happens. And we ended up having all the kids, the girls and the boys, the blind and the deaf, all in one big courtyard, about slightly smaller than this hall, all playing together in this huge celebration of life. We had tug of war with blind and deaf. We had Nathan blowing up huge balloons and the kids chasing them from one side of the courtyard to the other. We had Kate here being a total clown, and Walter having some quiet games of chess in the corner, and other people just having lines of little children and giving them soap bubbles, holding the thing with the soap bubbles, and they would take turns at blowing, and other people doing face paints. And because there was so much, there was no fighting, there was no poking, there was no going into our bags to see what was there. There was just this sense of abundance and joy and celebration. And somehow it happened. So I'd like to end with that sense of celebration and abundance and joy, which is there for us everywhere, even in the difficult situations, even in the impossible situations. Even if there's no way to plan how to play with deaf and blind boys and girls, children together, that party is still available, is still possible. So let's just have a couple of quiet minutes.